This week, market volatility increased with the Dow Jones off 1,000 points on Monday, closing in the plus column on Friday. Hello, everyone. Chris Walczak back with you again. We've got another must-hear show this week lined up with two top-notch guests in the industry. That was a roller coaster ride of a week in the markets. The rebound in the U.S. equities indexes of a 1,000-point decline on Monday on the plus column by Friday, I think it tested the intestinal fortitude of many investors. All eyes now are on the Federal Reserve for signs of the impending rate hike. So to help make sense of these highly volatile market conditions, economic analyst Jeffrey Christian of CPM Group joins the show. He says a Fed rate hike doesn't make much sense, given the recent equities and currency market worldwide. He's watching for signs that investors in China start to take profits off the table, redirecting that capital into the precious metal sector. Then David Nicosi of Vermilion Technical Research makes his debut on the show. He deciphers the market dynamics from a technical perspective, in particular relative strength analysis. He claims his research is well over 95% accurate. Although he thinks market conditions are oversold, he does expect further downside in the equities markets as we progress. However, he likes the Nikkei index. You can look at the latest chart at ticker symbol DXJ. That's the Nikkei ETF. He's expecting a 10-year bull run in Japan. You might say he's wildly bullish on the rising sun. And he's watching closely for signs of a bottom in the precious metals markets, looking for one of those head and shoulders or double, triple bottoms. And we'd like for you to call in your questions and comments. You can do so at 1-206-6665-370. It's not toll free, and we'd like to take your questions and comments 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can leave a question, include your name, or remain anonymous if you like. And then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly cloudy weather appeared over the New York COMEX exchange this week on the heels of hawkish comments from Fed governors, which resulted in dollar strength that put downward pressure on the precious metals. Gold shed, though, only $26, finishing at $11.34 an ounce. Silver off about 77 cents, 5%, finishing the week at $14.55 an ounce. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index dropped 3 points, off 6% at $48.82, while West Texas Intermediate crude blasted higher by $5, finishing up with a gain of 12% at $45 per barrel. What a week for black gold. A top story moving the markets. A Federal Reserve official hinted at renewed monetary stimulus, boosting interest in the safe haven as a hedge against inflation. In an interview on Friday on Bloomberg, the Minneapolis Fed president promoted alternative methods to keep rates low. Nevertheless, the non-voting member of the Fed noted how tame inflation could curtail rate hike plans. The comments were made at the annual conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, of central bank officials. In addition, St. Louis Fed President James Bullard noted the intense global market volatility. U.S. rates will likely remain the big focus for gold buyers, with U.S. payroll numbers next week as a key focal point. Yet, with only three remaining FOMC meetings in this year, traders will be watching the Jackson Hole meeting, I think, most closely, as Fed officials tip their hand regarding the upcoming policy guidance at the event. The next FOMC meeting is scheduled for September 16th. That's about 2 weeks. Meanwhile, on Thursday, the stronger-than-expected gross domestic product report indicated that the economy is performing better than expected, with second-quarter U.S. GDP growth revised up to 3.7%. That's from just 2.5%. That encouraged dollar strength substantially, and that put some downward pressure on our favorite group. Strong economic output tends to precede inflation, though, which put the Fed governor, I think, in a more hawkish mood. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, clearly dollar strength capped the two-week rally in the precious metals sector this week. Investors are willing to, I think, wait another couple of weeks to see if the Fed will follow through with the expected quarter-point rate hike. If they balk, expect a big gold rally. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, Partly sunny weather appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week in the wake of last week's 1,000-point rout in the Dow on Monday. As I mentioned, the index dropped another 1,000 points before then rallying again. The blue chips finished the day off 588 points, but that was well off the lows. Market fragility is gauged by the VIX index, which soared to 50, the highest reading in years. However, as the week progressed, volatility dropped markedly, leading to a mildly profitable week for the bulls. Wednesday and Thursday marked the largest 2-point gain in market history as investors added shares to their portfolios at bargain prices. The Dow Jones Industrials finished the week up 0.5% at 17,477, adding 183 points. The S&P ended at 1988, up 18 points, 1%, while the NASDAQ finished up 122 points. What a rally there, 3%, finishing at 4828. Moving on, the key story driving the markets this week surrounded the ambiguity over the upcoming Federal Reserve rate hike decision. One media report indicated that Stanley Fischer, the Fed's second in charge, said his colleagues have yet to decide if they will raise rates in 2 weeks. The Commerce Department announced on Friday that U.S. consumer spending increased 0.3% in July, which in combination with the robust GDP revision certainly made economic conditions seem more sanguine. Bottom line on Wall Street. Fear continues to climb to those excessive levels with our favorite 7-component fear index near record lows and the VIX index showing complete capitulation. Although it's early, a bottom should be very close at hand. For all of next week's forecasts and stock candidates, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Well, we're so glad you've chosen GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and news information source. Today's featured guest, Jeffrey Christian from CPM Group. Jeffrey Christian, managing partner of CPM Group. It's been several years since we've had him on the show. He's a prominent analyst and advisor in the commodities and precious metals sector for several decades now, well known within the financial community. Welcome back, Jeffrey Christian.
Hey, it's great to be back, Chris.
Before the show, you mentioned that you're recently back from South Africa, that you have some interesting contacts there in the mining sector. Tell us more, please.
Well, actually, we go there at least twice a year, and sometimes it's three or four times a year. We have a number of clients there, mining companies and gold and platinum, government offices, and also a lot of institutional investors who take our research and advisory work. So at least twice a year, I go down there. Last week, I think I saw about 21 institutional investors. We spent a day with a gold mining company. We spent several hours with another gold mining company and quite a bit of time with some of the platinum producers down there, telling them what we're seeing, what our view is as to why the markets are going where they are and where we think they're going to go on the short-term and on the long-term basis.
Well, you know, I think we forget sometimes that South Africa is a member of the BRICS conglomerate of nations. In 2006, you penned Commodities Rising. It was certainly well-timed, but there has been quite a sea change since that point, since 2011, just an abysmal, tough, and challenging time for the sector. Can you give people an idea of where we are in the correction in the commodities sector?
Yeah, what we've been saying really since 2006 or so, I guess, in 2005, 2006, what we were saying was that, you know, the commodities super cycle was nonsense. It was just marketing hype. There was an upward shift in investment and industrial demand for commodities, which was pushing prices higher, that we would get into a cyclical correction within a longer-term secular bull market. And from what CPM Group's analysis tells us now is that we're probably 3 years into that cyclical correction in commodities, and we might have a couple more years to go. Short-term perspective and medium-term perspective, we expect continued weakness in demand and prices for a lot of commodities. We think most of the decline is behind us, and the prices will just more move sideways than then downward further. And then in a couple of years, you know, by late 2017, early 2018, what you might see is a major change in investor perceptions of risks on a governmental and an economic and a financial level, which could lead to a renewed upward bull market in these commodities, coinciding with a downturn in supply due to the period of low prices that we're going through now.
So you don't see the shift in mentality at the FOMC, to a more hawkish stance, if you will. They're just reacting to the market? They're not actually pulling the strings?
I don't think the Fed pulls the strings. And in fact, I think the Fed has lost an enormous amount of market power and respect over the last couple of years, because it's been, you know, talking about raising interest rates really for a theoretical reason, not because the economic trends and conditions in the U.S. economy suggest it. You know, they're trying to restart lending to small and medium-sized businesses and households, but they're doing it in what I think is a totally inappropriate way. And it's not just me. I think a lot of people are looking at the Fed over the last couple of years and saying the Fed has really not been playing its cards well. So I think that the Fed is following economy, and, you know, related to that, we have been saying that we thought it'd be a smaller, later increase in interest rates, and now we're saying it's going to be smaller and later, as is everybody else. But in addition to that, they might just sort of come back and say, look, things have changed with the Chinese change in monetary policy, with the volatility in the markets, and what seemed to make sense a couple of years ago about raising interest rates just may not make sense going forward. So they might just back off completely. I don't think they will, because I think that they're going to try to save face as much as they can. And I don't think that, you know, my view is, you know, let's be honest and just come clean and get on with it. Their view probably is going to be to make some small changes. But even if you look at what they were saying that they were planning, which was, you know, a series of 25 basis point increases in interest rates over a couple of years, if you look at what they expect, they're looking at interest rates of about 2.8% by the end of 2017. You know, inflation will be about 2%. That means that real interest rates will be 0.8%. That's not enough to either accomplish what they say they want to accomplish, nor to entice investors out of other markets. I mean, 0.8% real interest rates, 2.8% nominal rates, that's not going to cause people to say, oh, I feel comfortable investing in interest-bearing treasuries at this point. So I think that their policy is ill-conceived, and I think that they realize it now, too, and that's one of the reasons why you're seeing the dollar fall as sharply as it is over the last several trading days.
And so you then wouldn't attribute that to lowered expectations of the rate hike at the September and December FOMC meetings?
Oh, no, it's definitely occurred. I mean, if you go back 2 weeks ago before the Chinese announcement, I think the probability rating in the market on the CME's interest rate hike chat board was something like 54% chance of an interest rate hike in September. We were saying we thought it probably would come in December. But within like a week of the changes in Chinese monetary policy, that had dropped down to like 28%. And the majority of people are now saying that they expect an interest rate hike in December. Given the market volatility, I think it would be extremely inappropriate for the Fed to increase interest rates in September. And the market seems to agree with that view.
Firstly, I'd say I think the situation is ambiguous, because on the one hand, we see much better unemployment numbers. We see a somewhat tame inflation figure. We've had a solid housing recovery, as witnessed in the HGX Philadelphia Housing Index. These, I think, are key metrics that the Fed officials and governors are watching closely. You know, now that we've reached their targets for the most part, I think they'd like to see a little more inflation. It would seem as though they have the wiggle room required to pull the trigger on a couple at least of rate hikes. But I've seen the numbers you're referring to, too. At the upper end of their forecast, they're talking as high as 3.25% in the years coming forward on those rate hikes. And that I just find very difficult given the tenuous state of the domestic economy. And give us an idea of how this could affect the precious metals sector on a forward basis, please.
You know, the first thing is if you're looking at the Fed delaying or even abrogating its plans to raise interest rates, that's good for gold. And we've seen that in the $100 increase in gold prices from the trough to the peak over the last few weeks. So I think that's good. But, gold ultimately, in my mind, responds to uncertainty and volatility in the world, whether it's economic or financial market or monetary or political. And what I think you're moving into is a much more volatile period for financial markets, for currencies, and a lot greater amount of uncertainty. The volatility is based on uncertainty about where the world's going, where China's going, where Europe is going. You've had some diminution of risk, and people have realized that Greece's debt renegotiations is nothing more than a debt rescheduling. It's not the end of Europe or anything. But you've seen an increase in risk in China, in the United States, and on a global basis that I think trumps the Greek movement toward a resolution of its debt situation. So I think that what you're finding is that investors will probably be much more interested in gold going forward than they have been over the last couple of years. If you go just looking at the Chinese stock market dropped 25% in June, but Chinese investors did not bail out and buy gold. What they did is they bought stocks because even after it had fallen 25%, it was still up 85% from a year earlier. Now you're seeing the stock market down even more. It's gone to a lower level than it was in June. And, we're waiting to hear from our Chinese clients. We want to know if Chinese investors are taking the current sell-off and the current recent devaluations and prospects for further devaluations of the yuan as an opportunity to get out of stocks and start buying gold. That's what they did back in 1993 when the government was moving to devalue the yuan, and that's what they may do again. We don't have insights as to what the Chinese investors are doing right now. We hope to have them in 24 hours or so. But, the thing is that in June, they took a sell-off in the stock market as a buying opportunity for stocks. And at some point, they're going to say, this isn't a short-term drop in a speculative bull market. This is the end of the bull market. And when that comes, especially tied in with the yuan devaluation, I think the Chinese investors will return to gold and they'll return in volume.
Then you're not one of these who expects a repeat of the 1980s and 1990s in the precious metals sector.
Well, it's a repeat in that there's a cyclicality there, but I don't think, if you look at the I think what we're looking at is a repeat of the period 1997 to 2002. As opposed to a repeat of the period 1980 to 2002. You were in a very broad downward market, sideways to lower market across commodities for 22 years there. I don't think that we're looking at 22 years of boring or downward commodity prices. I think you're looking at 5 years, which is, as I said, we see it as a cyclical decline in a secular bull market. And I think so, we're looking at, like I said, 2 years, 3 years from now, we're looking at a number of commodity prices starting to rise, gold in particular, for a variety of reasons. So that's sort of the historical model that we're looking at.
Okay. Let's move over to the energy sector. West Texas Intermediate crude has fallen out of a multi-year, 5-6 year consolidation after a huge run to, close to 145. And now it has really started to pick up some momentum on the downside in recent weeks. Some folks are calling for a $20 target. Give us an idea of your feeling on the sector, please.
Right now I'm wrong because I said on Chinese internet television last 2 weeks ago. I think prices around $40 are the base, and you know we're down to about $38 or so right now. You know, clearly they can spike down. I think that oil is going to be a good buy at some point, but I'm fascinated by the oil industry right now because you have a series of short-term and long-term factors, all of which are up for redefinition. So you have short-term changes in supply rising. You have short-term changes in demand where new technologies like LED lighting and other efficiencies are reducing the per unit and per capita electricity and energy requirements. And then you have short-term political events. You have, you know, definite commodities war. You know, the Cold War between the U.S. and Russia is clearly being reflected in lower oil prices. Political animosity between the United States and Saudi Arabia and Iran is clearly being reflected in Saudi and U.S. oil policies. You know, you've got a lot of political and economic factors as well as market fundamentals. And then you also have a big series of long-term changes, political, economic, financial, but also fundamentals. You know, I started off in 1975 in university. The first commodity I studied was the oil market. And in 1975, we were coming out of the 1973 oil embargo. OPEC had flexed its muscles for the first time. You had a tremendous increase in oil prices during the oil embargo in 1973 into early 74, threw us into a pretty nasty recession. And what you had in 1975 is what you have in 2015. You have an energy complex that is entirely up for redefinition. You've got fracking and shale oil recovery. You have the internationalization of the natural gas market and a tremendous increase in natural gas supply and demand. You have a revival of interest in your in nuclear power. Solar and wind are now cost competitive and are taking big strides around the world. I believe that, like Iowa, has, for example, about a third of its electricity comes from wind power now, and it expects to be at 50% of its electricity coming from wind power in a couple of years. And then on the demand side, you have new technologies which are, again, further reducing per unit of GDP and per capita energy requirements. So the whole energy complex seems, you know, up for a major redefinition. It'd be a fascinating time to be, you know, a full-time oil analyst at this point because I think everything is up for change. And what that means for oil prices, I do not know. I don't think they're going to go to $20. I think they could spike down there, but I'm a buyer probably at anything below 40.
No, I am as well. And I wonder then if you are factoring in this economic downturn or at least sluggishness that we're seeing in Shanghai, Peking, and China, or at least maybe looking forward to a time as we start to see economic indicators turn up as a great time to start adding energy-related investments to the portfolio.
Absolutely. I mean, look, we are worried. Our view is that China has gone through some cyclical and secular changes, that the GDP has fallen to 6.5%, 7.5% level. We think that the Chinese government has the capacity to maintain growth there, so we're not necessarily looking for Chinese growth to slow significantly further. But, you know, China, like the rest of the world, is up for redefinition. They clearly have accelerated their move to a convertible yuan. They're not there. And then domestically, they went from a centrally planned economy to a centrally managed economy, and now they're going to something less managed than it was. And they realize they have to do that because of the growth in the Chinese economy and the number of economic players there. And that's a tremendous amount of uncertainty with big tensions within the Chinese Communist Party leadership, because quite frankly, you know, their view has always been, we'll give you economic liberalization as long as you don't ask for political liberalization. And there are people, political scientists, who say, no, it doesn't work that way. You know, as people develop economically, they demand more political liberalization, and that's going to have to happen. And there are people within the Chinese Communist Party who say, we must not let that happen. But then there are other people, including the president, who say we have to let it happen and we have to manage it as best as we can. So it's a fascinating time to watch what's going on there.
As this dialogue winds down, if you could put together a hypothetical portfolio for investors, let's say over the next year or two, would you mind filling in the blanks, please?
That's hard to say, and it really depends on what, you know, the financial position of an individual investor. But, you know, I think that a good portfolio would probably be poised to take positions, you know, in stocks, bonds. I wouldn't get into bonds that much. I just don't quite understand the bonds. I have a large amount of my own funds in cash right now. I do have stocks, and I'll be looking to add to the stock market position as soon as I feel that the current spasm is over. And when I say the current spasm, I think that you will see a rebound in a few days in many stock markets, but that the market could move to newer lows in September and October. So I'm not looking for a really stronger stock market probably until November or December. So I might be nibbling, and I might be buying a long S&P ETF over the next few days or a couple weeks, but I probably wouldn't look to increase my long position in the stock market until November, December. And I should, you know, be honest, I have also been trading short S&P ETFs. I bought some in the second quarter with the expectation that the market would move downward, and I've liquidated some of that position to take profits today, actually, but I still have some of that short position there. In the commodities markets, I like gold. I'm a little bit worried about silver, but it is incredibly low. Platinum and palladium, they may not move up sharply for a year or two, but I think from a longer-term perspective, they're interesting. Gold, the same thing. I'm not necessarily looking for it to fall to 1,000. I'm not necessarily looking for it to go to 1,300 in the next couple quarters. Longer term, beyond 2017, I wouldn't be surprised to see gold prices move sharply higher, especially depending on what happens with the U.S. presidential election. Oil prices, again, I think below $40, they're a buy. I wouldn't try to buy them right now. I'm waiting to see the price and the global financial markets stabilize, but then I'll probably be an oil buyer. Copper I like a little bit. I'm not as wildly optimistic as some people, but I do think it could rise too.
Anything that we've not covered today that you'd like to share with the listeners, perhaps some topicality or something in your writings or any anecdote that you've picked up you'd like to share with folks today?
In terms of gold, because I guess GoldSeek probably is more interested in gold than other things. I mean, one of the things that we've seen over the last 2 months, July and August, have been a couple of announcements by the People's Bank of China. They have made a major long-term structural change in their attitudes toward gold. They have announced a large addition to their monetary reserves in July as of June, and then they announced that they bought another 600,000 ounces in July. And I think that is a very important factor because it represents a major central bank with a lot of other central banks that respect it, making a, like I said, long-term structural change in its attitude to be more pro-gold.
They're trying to convince the IMF that the yuan is worthy to be part of the reserve currency basket. So by, you know, increasing transparency there from, what was it, 5 or 6 years without letting anyone know their game plan on the precious metals, now to, it looks like they're changing to perhaps monthly announcements in order to cajole the IMF and convince them that this is a worthwhile currency.
Actually, yeah, the IMF guidelines are for its members to report its monetary reserves on a monthly basis. And actually, the Chinese government, the People's Bank, has been doing that. But what they've been doing is as they buy gold, they put it into a special account. And then they have, at least up until July, they would put it into a special account. And then every so often, they would add that special account gold to their monetary reserves. And, yeah, with the announcement in early August, that they had added 600,000 ounces in July, that suggests that they will now conform to the IMF guidelines and report adjustment changes on a monthly basis. And it also suggests that they've moved away from that pooling metal in a special account and then adding it to monetary reserves, that they may actually move to a practice of buy the gold, add it to the reserves. There are some reasons why the central bank didn't do that in the past and why it made its announcement in 2009 that it had bought metal from 2003 to 2009 and why they held it aside until June of this year. And by the way, most of the gold I think that they announced and added to monetary reserves in June, I think most of that gold was probably bought in 2013 and 2014 and not in 2009, 10, 11, 12. Just from what we've seen in the Chinese market. But, yeah, they want to be a – they realized after 2008 they need to be more assertive on an international monetary stage, and they are moving in that direction.
Do you have any comment on the speculation that may or may not be founded? The People's Bank of China may be covertly accumulating more than is announced, or is that just hearsay?
That's hearsay, and it's primarily put out by people who sell gold to investors to try to encourage them to buy more gold. And if our analysis of the gold flows into, around, and out of China suggests to us that the People's Bank probably is not accumulating these massive amounts that some people do. We did in our gold yearbook, we had a discussion where we showed how gold trades in China through the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and we showed how people can overestimate by 200-300% the amount of gold that's coming into the market because they don't understand the flow of gold within the gold market and the Shanghai Gold Exchange. So if you look at the outturn or the gold taken off of the SGE and you don't understand what you're looking at and the production of new scrap and reprocessing of it, you would overestimate it. And I think that that's what's been going on, although I think that the people who have done it, many of them are fully aware that they're inaccurate, but they're trying to find reasons to convince Western investors to buy gold in the middle of a bear market. And I think they latched on that as a story to promote. So, no, I don't buy that.
Jeffrey Christian, I wonder if you could tell people more about the services that CPM Group provides, including your commodities management, asset management, hedging opportunities for folks who have large exposure to the sector. You have consulting, financial advisory. Give them an idea, run the gamut here of what you can do to help our listeners today.
Sure. Well, we are a research-driven company. Our raw materials are research and analysis, and then we sell that. And for a lot of investors, probably the premier thing is to buy our gold or silver or platinum group yearbooks. They're like $180. They can find out about all this stuff at our website, which is cpmgroup.com. You can buy the reports either as e-books or as hard copies or as both on our website. Then what we do is after we have that research and analysis, we sell it in various forms. So research, we'll sell reports. We work as advisors for investors, usually large net worth individual investors or institutional investors. We work for our, mining companies, processors, refiners, smelters, users, financial intermediaries, central banks, governments. We provide our research to anybody who has a large exposure in precious metals or commodities, and they want to know where we think the market's going and why. And you can, there are a bunch of free reads at our website. If you go to our market views at our website, there are a lot of reports and presentations that people can read to give them a flavor of the kind of fundamental and macroeconomic research that we do.
Jeffrey Christian, thanks for taking time from the busy schedule, and we hope that you will return to GoldSeek.com later on in 2015 and in 2016.
Anytime.
All right, you're back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's special guest, David Nikoski from Vermilion Capital. My featured guest today ranks in that rare category of why didn't we ask them on the show before now? It's a pleasure to welcome David Nikoski, head of Vermilion Capital Management, chief technical strategist. Welcome, David Nikoski.
Chris, I appreciate it.
I wonder if you might give us an overview of volatile markets. We haven't seen anything quite like this since 2008. You have a substantial background professionally in the technical arena, and we have just so many technical analysts listening to our voices. Give us an idea, just what you see, starting with U.S. equities.
We saw this pattern once before. We had highlighted the similar pattern back in May 4th of 2010. What you have is a pattern. If you think of behavioral economics, what you tend to see is, you know, human patterns repeat themselves. And oftentimes these patterns are put onto a chart. And in this case, what we saw was a diamond pattern. And the same pattern, like I said, took place back on May 4th of 2010 and in 29, exactly. So, and I guess when we look at kind of history, we may see the patterns back in the past. And I think what you're seeing today is the markets move much faster. When I started in the business back in 87, and I actually got laid off in the stock market crash of 87, so through experience, you know, one thing that we had back then is we didn't have the trading systems that we do today. So the market's much faster, but you still get the patterns that still present themselves. And it shows human emotion, fear, and greed. And on this pattern that we saw, this diamond pattern, if you break to the downside, you can have explosive moves to the downside. You had that after March 4th of 2010 or May 4th of 2010, and you just most recently had this pattern occur on Wednesday of last week. So to us, it wasn't a complete shock. We highlighted the pattern and saw it breaking to the downside, and the subsequent days are obviously where you get the most chaos. Where we are sitting right now in terms of the market is we're going to have volatile trading periods, and you're going to walk in one day and feel great. The next day, you're going to be down several hundred points. These quant systems, they'll turn on and off, and these are things that you didn't have in the past, but you see the markets get a lot more volatile during these corrective periods than we've seen ever in the past. I think we're in for kind of a bumpy ride, and as more news flows comes in, the market will respond accordingly in dramatic fashion.
Well, I certainly concur. I'm getting proprietary oversold. I find it very interesting that you identified the diamond pattern. I think there in the S&P 500, there was a complex head and shoulders pattern, two of my favorites for tops and bottoms. Interestingly, inverted head and shoulders are probably my favorite to get me into the trends. I'd like to talk about just what we've seen happen. Last week, at least on a point, not percentage basis, less than 6% in the Dow on the downside, over 1,000 points. Interestingly, though, on Monday, intraday, roughly 1,000-point swing, ending at about 588 on the Dow Jones Industrials average. I'd like your thoughts on what traders and investors can take away from that type of volatility. I mean, obviously, you've pointed to quants. You're looking at the algorithmic trading that so many of us are involved in, robotic trading and whatnot. That takes the individual out of it, so there's no emotion. Do you think that this is going to have a negative overall impact, or are the markets just a self-clearing, invisible hand?
You know what? I think it does take away confidence from investors because what they realize is that the market in many cases are actually not trading on fundamentals. And I, as a technician, you know, that's my job, is not to pay as much attention to the fundamentals as I should to trends. And the problem is, you know, technicals work great, you know, and relative strength is what is the theory that we subscribe to here at Vermilion. And relative strength works great 98 to 99% of the time. It's that 1% of the time where you get these cataclysmic shocks that all of a sudden relative strength really doesn't matter. And when I say it doesn't matter, I don't mean that it truly doesn't matter. What I'm saying is that you will take out the strongest areas of the market for the last leg or the capitulatory decline. And more recently, what you've seen is obviously in the last month and a half, you've seen a lot of the semiconductor-related stocks take it on the chin. You've seen the biotechs, which surprisingly on Friday of last week, despite a weak tape, the XBI, which is a biotech index, was actually positive. For a decline on the Dow of 500 points, that's pretty amazing, even though there's not really a correlation between the Dow and biotechs. But one would think that you would have a weak tape across everything, especially those areas that are most speculative. So I do believe that, you know, again, we're going to be in for a volatile period. I think technicals are a tool in the arsenal toolbox, but I do think that this algorithmic trading and the quant type trading, when it does go awry, it really goes awry. And if you look back in history at some of the biggest quant type of disasters or system trading Long-term capital, 98, perfect one. You saw this also take place back in the decline of 08 and 09. A lot of these systems were shut off. A lot of major brokerage firms actually shut down their quant systems because they had to keep funding them through the decline because they were popping on and off, and that's what created a lot of the volatility in 08 and 09.
I'd like to move on to just how this might impact the Fed. The ECB and several other colleagues around the world are going to continue with their quantitative easing. The Fed claims the FOMC will more than likely raise by 0.25% the benchmark lending rate next month in September, and then perhaps once again in December. I'd like to hear your thoughts on whether or not you buy their rhetoric and just how that might impact our listeners' portfolios.
I'm in the camp that I don't believe their rhetoric. I think they want to stand firm. They want to show that they're in control, and I think that's in essence what they're trying to communicate to the general public. I don't think that the market can right now handle an increase, especially with what we see going on around the world. And one of the reasons that, you know, we have very low interest rates here, aside from the quantitative easing, is that when you look at European yields on their treasury bonds, Germany's yielding 73 basis points. The U.S. is at 2.1%. The European Central Bank is actually charging banks for their reserves. So what they're doing is they're actually coming over here and buying treasuries and pushing our interest rates down just in order to collect the differential between the U.S. yield and the German yield. And I think that's creating, in my view, a bond bubble here. And remember, bubbles can stay intact for a long time. So could we go lower or can we go slightly higher? I think the jury is out. You know, if we break through, you know, a 2.6% level, then we're going to see a secular change in interest rates. But as of now, we're staying much lower than anyone could have possibly imagined 3, 4, or 5 years ago.
On to the government intervention issue. We hear of circuit breakers virtually across the board in the Shanghai Index. On the one hand, we see essentially the markets supported by their officials, which seems admirable. I mean, at least on paper, it looks really good. But I think the flip side of this is 8, 9, 10% correction in a day or a matter of days following 30, 40% losses, I think is indicative of structural weakness. We nearly saw circuit breakers come into play in the New York Stock Exchange on Monday, another 0.5%, maybe 1% or so, and circuit breakers would have been triggered. Give us an idea whether you see it as a positive or a negative.
I think that, you know, when you move something down so far, so fast, you're eventually going to get a reflex rally. There's no doubt that they're in a secular bear over there. I think a lot of that weakness and a lot of the substandard growth that you're getting out of China that everyone expected, as a believer in relative aspect of everything in the world, being a technician studying relative strength, I think what you really have is you have, for the last several decades, you've had China stealing market share on away from Japan and some of the other Asian countries. And I think what you've done is you flipped that switch where the Japanese yen has now weakened so dramatically against currencies around the world. Japan is in a secular bull market, and I think that's what you see is the baton being handed from one region to another. And I think Japan, on a long-term basis, is a screaming buy. The question is how much do we pull back here? We're still, you know, weighing through the charts and looking to see, look for an entrance, an opportunity to enter Japan once again. Not that we're out of it. We've recommended an overweight for a couple of years. I think I'll be there for, you know, a decade. I don't marry a lot of fundamental work with my technical. I track every market around the world. And I break it down into a sector, a geographic region, sector, a group. Based upon how we view the market, not based upon S&P groups or JICS codes. One of the things that we found in our group is that when you look at some of these JICS codes or S&P groups, you have companies like Ford and AutoZone in the same group. I can't study a group with companies that I believe actually are not competitors. So by graphing, and what we did was we went back and collected all the data going back to 1970 on every stock that's ever traded, whether it's bought out, bankrupt. I have over 30,000, almost 30,000 stocks in my U.S. database. What that gives me is it doesn't give me the survivorship bias. And one of the things that I think that many tech nations gravitate to is when they focus on popular indices, I think they're doing an injustice to the value that a sector or a group adds to the market. And let me give you an example. When you look at the S&P 500 today from 2000 and comparing it to today's S&P 500, what most people don't realize is you have about 180 names that have changed in that index from 2000. You're not looking at the same index you did back then. One of the things that you see with, for example, the Dow, here you add a stock called Apple to it. In 2000, you added Microsoft and Intel to the Dow. The Dow was never meant to be a technology-laden index. It was supposed to be an industrials. Now we add Apple to the Dow after an unbelievable run, and we add it when it's the most expensive company in the world. Like, now it has some legitimacy when it gets over $500 billion market cap, which is beyond me. So I like to consider myself an expert, but I'm no more of an expert than the guys trying to calculate what companies should go in each index. And I think there's a lot of historical examples of where I think they've gone off track. So one of the things that we do is we look more for sector rotations. And I think when you look at the data that supports that, you know, if at the end of the year I told you, and just hypothetically, if I said, hey, the S&P 500 is going to go to 2,500. If I said something like that, I better be directing you what sectors are going to take you there. Because when you look at the historical data, the deviations between sectors, between the best sector and the worst sector from 1970 to present is 45% on an annual basis. Second best minus the second worst is 26%. So if I can get you overweight the two best sectors on an annual basis, you're going to perform your benchmark regardless.
And the irony there is that so many top professionals fail to even match, let alone exceed, the indices. That gives one an incredible leg up. Even just 1% or 2% over any period of time leads to almost exponential growth, a vertical asymptote. I really appreciate that induction a posteriori here regarding inclusion and exclusion of key components within the indices. We're not, as you say, looking at the same index from the year 2000, the year 2005, the year 2010, 15, 16, maybe not so wise or prudent to then speculate on just what is simply not as relevant as it would be had they kept the same basket. Let's move on now to the precious metals. Several years after a remarkable 12-year bull market in the yellow metal, give us an idea of your targets, if you have any, and whether or not the precious metals will become a more savory index in the next 12 to 24 months, please.
I think that, you know, right now it's just not an asset that the world wants to own, obviously. You did become parabolically extended down. You did have a reflex rally, but you haven't broken those longer-term downtrends. I think the market would be much more excited about it if we broke those longer-term downtrends. And until that happens, it's kind of a wait-and-see attitude. But every sign is there right now that it's capitulated. The question is are we going to go sideways and go into a trading range for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, or 12 months? And until it breaks out, we're not going to prognosticate what the price target is, because we need to have it form a pattern. And those patterns are going to be reversal patterns that you see on every chart. And it's going to be a head and shoulders bottom, a double bottom, triple bottom. It's going to be something that's very visible to every technician out there. But until we get those patterns prognosticating, you know, again, like I said, I don't do any time prognosticating where the indexes are going to go, because I think it's all about sector orientation. On the gold chart, until I get those patterns, can I really prognosticate where intermediate term moves are going to take you? Right now, I can visibly see it's extremely, extremely oversold. But we need something that is going to rejuvenate the desire for gold. And what that is, it's oftentimes you don't know what that is until it occurs. And It's going to have to be on a global basis. Right now, I feel that we're in much more of a currency war. You brought up an interesting comment earlier. It's my view that when you have a government that believes that they can tether a currency, the fallout and the corrections from that are so powerful, and they usually upset the balance of the market. And a perfect example was China tethering the yuan to the U.S. dollar, and all of a sudden having this, you know, untethering of letting it depreciate 4%. Another perfect example is look what happened to Switzerland when they untethered from the euro. It seems that everyone will tether it during a period of time that they don't want it to weaken too significantly. But when a currency strengthens too much, then they untether and you get these cataclysmic shocks because no one's used to it. And I think that's the problem with what we're seeing in the market, whether it's QE. We have all of this support that no one can determine when it's going to come off, what it's going to do, and what cataclysmic shock it's going to have.
Clearly, you are looking for signs of technical strength to re-enter the precious metals sector. Is there any area that I've failed to cover today that you would like to share as this dialogue winds down?
Right now, we're seeing a visible breakout of the euro against the U.S. dollar. And we've been underweight the U.S. manufacturing sector and those companies that have exposure to, you know, mainly Europe. But you're seeing that, you know, with the climb in the U.S. Dollar, it's put a disproportionate weakness on those companies that do business outside the U.S. With the change in the euro that we're seeing right now, I won't go as far as saying that we're going to see a complete reversal in the dollar versus the euro, but it does appear that we're establishing a bottom. Therefore, the wind is changing on some of those companies that do business in Europe, that you're probably going to see that the next quarter you're not going to have the magnitude of earnings decline based upon the strength in the dollar versus the euro. In other words, we're starting to see that wind vane change. And I think that's a good sign for some of these larger cap U.S. companies that do business in Europe. It's certainly a welcome sign, but one of the things that I, as a technician, I would like to see is some of those commodity sectors to stop going down. I don't need them to outperform. I just need them to stop going down, and this market could certainly get some gas under it. We're, you know, as you said, we're seeing levels of oversold nature. The percentage of stocks trading above the 50-day moving average, you know, we're sitting right around 8%. You don't see that number very often. It's commensurate with the low that we saw in March of 2009, commensurate with the low that we saw in June, July of 2010, 2011, and 2012. So we are at a level which we can at least stabilize, but in many cases when we have a sell-off like we did, we'll actually undercut the previous low, and we can do it by anywhere from 5 to 8%, and then we can form a bottom. In most cases, it's been a head and shoulders or a double or triple bottom.
I mean, that's exactly what we see happening. In fact, I've never seen reading, even back testing, quite as oversold now, and I'm trying to talk some of my colleagues back from the ledge, tell people more about the exciting services that you provide and what folks will find at Vermilion Capital Management's website when they click the links at goldseek.com.
What you'll find is you'll find some examples of our research. Most of our research is around a proprietary relative strength product that we've been doing for a number of years. Most of our work has been towards institutions, the large institutions. Have an extensive background in technical analysis. Our product is, again, it's relative strength oriented. You'll see some of the products that we put out there. We do a lot of sector calls, a lot of group calls. We have an international product that we're rolling out as well that looks at markets all around the world, broken into geographic and by sector and by group orientation. I think it's some of the only known technical research to this magnitude out on the marketplace. I think you'll find it fascinating, and I think it'll give you some great ideas of what's happening around the globe.
I want to encourage every listener to direct your web browsers over to Vermilion Capital Management. What a pleasure having you on the show today. It's just, as I said in the intro, a shame we haven't had the pleasure sooner.
Certainly. Thank you for having me on the show, and I appreciate it.
Hey. Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. The push and pull and massive change and market capitulation is upon us. The U.S. stock market has seen massive sell-offs this past week, attributed directly to China, with a minor rebound and then nothing. Listening to the famous Man in the Street mainstream talk radio interviews on the days with the biggest volatility and declines, it's as if people, including the reporters asking the questions, were momentarily awoken from their 7-year quantitative easing hypnotic sleep, just long enough to say they hoped it did not affect their 401k plan. The world has been lulled into a false sense of security the past 7 years by attempting to solve debt problems with more debt. The 2008 economic collapse never ended. It just moved into slow motion, like a tree collapsing. You hear the timbers snap, and part of the tree comes down and causes financial mayhem like it did in 2008. But what about when the rest of that tree starts collapsing? But the only difference is this time the whole forest has the ability to become uprooted and reset. We've entered that forest now. We entered it this past week. The financial change we have been anticipating, that some have been fearing, that others have been trying to understand and prepare for, is upon us. There are many in the resource community that I follow and respect. Let me name just three who have commented this week in the boldest of terms: Jim Sinclair, Greg Manarino, and Egon von Greyers, that what has happened in the markets over the past week marks the beginning of a systemic collapse that will have profound implications for not only gold and silver, but the global economy as a whole. Beyond the economics, I want to ask you if you are prepared with your network of friends, your family, and are you located where you want to be geographically? Or are you going to wait and see if something really happens, and just how bad it is, thinking you can always get from here to there because I've got some gold or silver coins? Did you ever think that maybe there's some things that may not be able to be bought with gold or silver in a crisis? Did you ever think that maybe you should make certain plans and lifestyle changes now? The secret to conquering change is being prepared for it. This month marks my 8th year doing business and economic commentaries for GoldSeek.com radio. If there's something you've been wanting to do to prepare for yourself, your family, and your future, do something about it now. Insurance is cheap ahead of time, but is nearly impossible to acquire when there is any kind of economic smoke, and it becomes immediately unavailable when there is an economic fire. The forest we entered this week has the potential to become an economic firestorm. Are you ready? Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @conquerchange. Thanks, Chris.